All right, aviators, welcome to another Motivation Monday. It's good to have you here. Got some great questions today for you from the community. And of course, all of these are answered live. So if you ever want to participate live in these Motivation Mondays, just show up Monday morning and you can see those. Now, you can also get this on the Aviator Cast podcast. I'm posting it there now. You can also find it on the angleofattack.com blog. And lots of different sources in between. Feel free to reach out on social media. I'm always there, I'm always active, and it would be great to speak with you and learn a little bit more about you and help you along your way. So hope you enjoy this Motivation Monday. There's some great discussion and some different questions this week. So good luck and keep taking those steps forward in your aviation training. Tips for the oral side of the instrument check ride. So there are a lot of different ways you can go this direction, and I get this question quite a lot. And so I actually created a product called Check Ride Ace that helps you prepare for your check ride. I have it for private instrument and commercial, and so I'll just mention that right out the gate because I answered it in a practical way with things you can actually use to study and prepare for that oral. So checkrideace.com, you can go there and check that out. But I think, again, the best thing to do when you're preparing for a check ride is just make sure that you are studied up. And this is for the oral component specifically, that you are studied up, because what a lot of people do is they get their written test done first before they go into training, or it's been a while since they've done their written test. Some of you may get that done near the end. That's not really how I recommend to do it, though, because I like people to focus on their flight training. So it's been a while if you do your written test first, because you know you've gone through the flight training now and you may have forgotten about a lot of that written test stuff. Now, that's not to say that the oral test is like the written test. In other words, it's not going to be this question and answer sort of interrogation format. It's more of a conversation, but you still need to go back and be able to pull from that knowledge that you have learned, mix that with what you have learned during your flight training, and then answer the questions or have that conversation within your oral test on your check ride. So that is that's my advice, is that, hey, you need to be able to study up and be ready for that oral test after being out of the knowledge part of your training for a while. And you know, what I did with Check Ride Ace to alleviate that is I created a 20-page study guide. I think it's 22 pages, and it's fill in the blank. So I don't just say, hey, here are all the answers, but I actually try to pull from your memory with all that you do know. And then what you don't know, you can go back and actually crack open the books and study again. But I found that to be very useful. It's specific to each check ride. So the instrument one is going to be very focused on the instrument components of what you need to know. So just keep that in mind, that in some way you need to go back and restudy the material and then bring that knowledge freshly back into the oral portion. But the oral portion is a conversation, is very scenario based. You'll get questions like, you're going for an instrument flight today, you have two friends with you, and the weather is looking like X, Y, and Z. Tell me how you would proceed. Those are the sort of questions that you would get. It's not, you know, what is the square root of the ILS on a rainy day? That's not really a question, but it's more holistic thinking of bringing all the decision making together, the risk management, the knowledge, the skill into one place. And that's what the oral test is all about, regardless of what check ride you're going for. So good question. Have any tips on remembering the numbers for the regulations? You know, this is actually an interesting question, because I myself, until I became an instructor, I really didn't dive down into knowing the numbers of the regulations. And the only reason that I learned it more as an instructor was because I was referencing it so much with students. And so I actually don't recommend wasting your time and your brain power on rote memorization of regulation numbers. You know, I'm not even a huge proponent anymore of having a far aim that you're tabbing. I think that the FAR aim is becoming, rather every year it changes a little bit, right? So they have these new copies of these FAR aim that come out every single year, and then it's refreshed. What I like to do, and I would recommend that everyone does this, is I would get an application, an app on your phone that is for the regulations. Get it from a reputable source, make sure that they're the type of people that are updating it when it is updated, and that becomes your reference. The reason that's really valuable is if you're out in the field, you're gonna have your phone, we know you're gonna have your phone with you. I really hope you're not carrying around your FAR aim as this big weight with you wherever you go flying. But you have the FAR aim with you, and you can reference the regulations on the fly when you need them. That's not to say that you don't have the knowledge of some of the regulations or many of the regulations that you need, but you know, you have them right there for reference if you are unsure about something. I find that compliance to the regulation and to the law is much better in scenarios like that than simply leaning on your knowledge that you learned that could have been years ago. So that is my advice, is actually have an application on your phone. It becomes searchable, so you search certain keywords and it'll pull up those regulations. Then you can read the actual words and be in better compliance with that. So that is my advice. And with that, you're not wasting the brain power on the regulation. Maybe you're using that brain power instead on interpreting that regulation and then exercising good risk management. So that's my advice on that. Hope that helped out. What is the best way to not get burnout during instrument training toward the end? So actually, Taylor, I did a podcast on this not too long ago about avoiding burnout and basically kind of the path to becoming an instrument pilot. So you can go and check that out at aviatorcast.com. I think it's in the 120s somewhere is where that podcast is. So basically, with anything, you've got to pace yourself with training, no matter what it is. And that's why, you know, people say, hey, can I train every single day? There are advantages to that, but I think there are also disadvantages to it in that you can get really burned out. I'm not sure in what sense you're getting burned out, Taylor. I think, you know, if I'm to guess, I would say the number one thing that people get burned out on with instrument is that it just seems like it's going on forever and it's never going to end and you're never really going to get it. And so my advice there with instrument to avoid that certain kind of burnout is just to realize that the flying of the airplane and the private pilot / VFR license is very critical. And you learn to fly the airplane there, you start to learn communications and a bunch of different things that are kind of your foundation, right? However, when you go to instrument training, it is completely different. You're learning a whole different set of skills. And in my experience and estimation for most people, it is actually the more difficult license to learn. Now, if you are going to go out in the real world and use this instrument license, then you will need to be really on top of your game. So while you can get your private pilot and kind of push it through and not be the perfect pilot at the end, and still leave with a lot to learn, I think with instrument, there's a much higher form of perfection that I would like to see people achieve at the check ride level if they are going to essentially leave the check ride and go out and use the instrument license. So just know that it's important safety-wise to play the long game, because if you're going to use that instrument ticket, you need to be really confident in it. So I would take a step back. Don't have so much anxiety about it. And just play the long game, do the instrument rating right, and get it done that way. I know that there are some other pressures there, like if you're at a Part 141 school, they want to put you through on the program and have you exactly set up on the hours you need to do. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but it is what it is. And of course, there are time and money pressures as well. So maybe one strategy for you to alleviate this would be to go on a multi-day trip with your instructor in the airplane and do just instrument things. you've done all the training, you have done the written test, you're essentially almost there, almost ready, and need to knock out a few requirements. Go on a multi-day, it could even just be an overnight trip if that's all you need to do, and be in the instrument environment the entire time and really solidify those skills. Really long story short, I failed my first check ride, instrument check ride, didn't have a very good instructor, didn't have good training, wasn't ready, wasn't prepared. And my second instrument check ride, I took control of it, and this was several years later, and really just did it right and took my time. And that's what I did, is I went on a multi-day trip into instrument conditions with a good instructor, and everything clicked, and I was confident, and I could go out and use the airplane right away in instrument conditions. So that's some food for thought, okay? I know that's kind of a lot all at once, but if you have any more questions, you can reach out to me. But that's my advice to avoid burnout and why it's so important to simply play the long game during your instrument training. Someone asked what app I'm using for the FAR AIM. I am using the ASA app. I think there are other apps that are designed a little bit better, and I'm not always very happy with the search function of the ASA app. I know for sure that I can trust ASA to keep that updated, so it's a little bit of a give and take, but there are several apps out there that will let you try their platform, so just go out and find out what works for you. Do you have to have a beard to be a good CFI? And there is mounting evidence right now that you actually do have to have a beard. Some of my best CFIs have had beards, so I don't know what it is, but maybe it's wisdom. I don't know what it is, but yeah, that could be a thing. Are loans beneficial for acquiring a commercial pilot license? And a commercial pilot license is one of the few times where I think a loan is okay. The reason is that you have some employment behind that when you're done. I don't agree with doing loans for just a recreational private pilot license. But that all boils down to just my personal opinion and how I like to have a return on investment. Most middle-class people are trying to, or should be trying to, do wise things with the money that they have. So getting a loan for something that's simply recreational isn't necessarily the smartest thing, but plenty of people, take out a lot of money to get their college done, get their career technically choice done. But what I really like about aviation is there is actually a job at the end of that training. So I am a big proponent of using aviation as an avenue to get those loans, because there is a job. Excuse me. However, there are smart ways to do that as well. So don't just go out and sign up for the biggest loan. Do your research, find a place that is of good quality, but also has a reasonable rate for you. Because you can get your training done anywhere from $60,000-ish all the way up to, that's at the high end even, for a Part 61. I would say even with a Part 61, you could get it done for, $40 at worst in a lot of places that are just mom and pop schools. But then you go to places that have really good financing, you're starting off at $100, and then you go to some of these colleges and it can be $300. So do your research, don't just blow a bunch of money. What are your tips and recommendations on cloud types and cloud forms to avoid when flying IMC? That's really interesting, because when you're IMC, you do learn a handful of different things on clouds to avoid, but you should already kind of know and have the tools to know and have the pre-flight planning to know what you're getting into, whether that's icing or whether that's convective activity, which is a fancy word for thunderstorms, and or it's heavy rain or snow, whatever it is. You should have a really good idea of what weather is coming. Here in the United States, we have fantastic weather reporting, at least in the lower 48. In Alaska, there's a lot lacking there. But we have fantastic weather reporting that can really help you drill down into the real picture of what's going on. So that said, you can still do this sort of pre-flight planning these days that essentially allows you to not have any of the fancy stuff on board. plan really well and go out and do things pretty safely. And then on the flip side of that, there are onboard things you can have now for, you know, onboard weather. There are plenty of other tools to use, like air traffic control and flight service while you're actually in the air. You know, they help you avoid certain things as well. I think icing is one of those things where it's kind of up to the pilot to know. You're not really going to get icing. You're not really going to get icing reports from air traffic control unless there's someone ahead of you that has a PIREP or something like that. So that's kind of my advice there, is that the cloud formations and the cloud types don't necessarily matter so much as the high quality pre-flight planning you're going to do to avoid those things in IMC. So yeah, that's my advice there, and I hope that's helpful. All right. I could go on and on about that subject. Now, actually, before I move on from this one, I want to make clear that you have to be really careful with the weather. You can't just say, hey, the weather's bad, and like it looks like there might be some icing, but there probably won't be, and so I'm just gonna go out and do it. You need to stay away from weather that is not good for you. I know that sounds like overly simplistic, but seriously, don't fiddle with it. Like, there's just way too many accidents that happen because people are pushing the envelope, okay? Stay plenty far away from these situations like icing and thunderstorms that would get you in trouble, especially when you're talking about IMC, which is instrument meteorological conditions, for those that don't know. It basically means you're in the clouds. You can't see these things coming, especially at night. So just stay away, okay? Delay your flight a few hours. Go a few hours earlier. There are plenty of strategies to employ to make sure that you're doing safe things. So while the pre-flight planning and everything can go really well, there are things that can change. And even while in flight with some of these nice tools, things can change. So be safe, give yourself a buffer, and focus on really solid planning and decision making. Should I fly with multiple instructors? I know that he is an instructor himself. You know, I think it depends. I think sometimes, first off, I think the general rule of thumb is it's best to stick with one instructor, because that instructor gets to know you pretty well and gets to know your learning style and hopefully recognizes that and can teach you the best. If you go with a new instructor midstream, you can often reset that clock, ends up costing you a little bit more money, but there are times and situations where that does become necessary. Maybe the training isn't working out for you, you don't mesh well personally with that person, or whatever it is, you can always make the switch. Now, all of that said, in my advanced ratings, I am of the mindset that it takes a village to raise a pilot, or maybe it takes an airport to raise a pilot. So I actually like flying with different people now and having different perspectives on what to do and how to operate. Just gives me a more holistic view. And then I guess from there, I synthesize my own way of doing things. I just really appreciate and honor the wealth of knowledge from multiple people. And now that I'm deeper into my career, I can basically learn something from anyone, even if I don't mesh with them the best personally. So I think initially you stick with one instructor if you can, but I'm also big on not sticking with someone that isn't working, because I do believe you are the boss and you should fire them if it's just not working. You have the power, you're paying the money, you are the customer. So keep that in mind. It's also good to get a different look from other instructors on the student to make sure that they are progressing well. So that is actually something that's called a stage check. It's used in Part 141 training, and I would suggest that people even use that in their Part 61 training. What's the most important thing for me to do once I have my private pilot license? This is interesting, because in my personal experience, I think the best thing to do once you have your private pilot license is to go out there and experience the world in a safe way. And maybe it's not the world, right? I'm not saying, hey, go out and do a circumnavigation of the globe. I'm not saying that. But go out there, do cross countries, learn new things. You know how to do that now, or at least the extent to which to do it, to be safe. Dip your toes in the water on different situations, different areas, different lengths of flight that are safe for you, and start to build that experience. There's something about being out there in the real world where it's completely up to you, and that is such a steep learning curve that you will learn more in those hours than maybe in your entire private pilot training. So keep it up, keep flying, and go out there and just experience new things. Find new cool airports in your area that you haven't gone to before. Fly with friends and buddies to places. You can split the cost when you do that. Remember that as a private pilot, you can do pro rata share on that. So that's a cheap way to get your hours if you're building up. But there's a reason why, if you're going to take the next step for your instrument training, that you need 50 hours of cross country time, because in that time you really learn a lot about being a good aviator. So go out there and just explore. That's my number one advice. So here's a question: where's the best place to get accurate winds aloft for my nav log? So the tool that I'm using these days is ForeFlight, because I can look at the different waypoints as I go along, and especially the airports, and see the winds aloft for that airport, the nearest winds aloft. So that's typically what I'm using when I do winds aloft. Now, that's actually considering that you're using ForeFlight just to get the winds and then dialing them on the paper, okay? Because if you use ForeFlight to do the actual flight planning, then those winds aloft are taken into account for everything. So they're automatically considered in your flight planning. So that's where I'm getting my winds aloft these days. I just think it's the easiest to navigate based on my route of flight. When you go in and do your briefing with ForeFlight, then you will get a log of the winds there as well, which just lays it out on what you're going to face as you fly. So that might be an even faster way to do it. And then, there you see the TAFs and the METARs as well. So that's how I'm seeing it these days. You don't have to have it from like the perfect, like the one source that's a page of winds aloft that you have to interpret. As long as that is official information coming through, even through an app, then you're good to go. I live in Minnesota. Do you need any rating for skis and to land on lakes and fields? So two different things there. You don't need a ski rating, which is pretty interesting, or an endorsement. You just can kind of do it. I've never really understood that, but I wouldn't want to go do it without some training. So find someone that knows what they're doing and then learn from them, because it'll be fun and you'll learn quite a bit, and it'll be great. I've actually never done any ski flying, but this is how you approach a lot of different areas of aviation. So do that. Now, landing on lakes and fields, that gets more into a legality issue or a permission issue if you can land on those lakes and fields. So that person that you're learning from will kind of know what you can and can't do, where you can and can't go. Otherwise, you can ask local instructors or other people on what you can do. In other words, you can't just land anywhere in an airplane. You've got to be a little bit careful with that. There were days where you could do that. In the beginning days of aviation, it was kind of a fun story. Lots of stories came out of pilots having to put down in a pasture, and then the farmer took them in for the night and fed them, and then they took off the next day when the weather was better. Those days are over for the most part. There are situations where that does still happen, but it's pretty rare. These days, people are a little bit more private and protective of their property, so just be careful of that component of it. Otherwise, go out and have fun. I've heard ski flying is a lot of fun. It was something I was going to pursue before I left Alaska to come down to California, and I'm really jealous now seeing all my friends out there just doing some beautiful ski flying in Alaska, so I definitely recommend it. And Minnesota is a good place to do that too. What's the best study program for instrument? So just right out the gate, I always mention this. I have an instrument ground school I'm proud of. It's a great ground school. I'm going to be making some improvements to it here in the next month or so. And then I also have Instrument Check Ride Ace, which is very helpful when you're winding down toward the end of your check ride there. But really, you want to find, for instrument, it's really important that regardless of where you go, you can find a ground school and a study program, as you phrase it, that gives you the whole picture of instrument. Because what I find is that a lot of these programs are just diving straight into the nuts and bolts of charts and communications and loss communication procedures, and you know, it just gets too messy too quick, and it seems like the student never truly learns the holistic big picture view of instrument flying and why things are happening. And then we can start to drill down into skills of the pilot inside the airplane, and then the knowledge and skills as they present themselves in flying the actual procedure. So starting big picture and working your way down, and I don't think there are a lot of programs out there that do that. I've really attempted to do that with my own program. So just keep that in mind in your shopping to make sure that it seems like they're trying to go that direction. I like this question. I always like this question because I will stand on this soapbox all day long. What's the key to being a good instructor? And I have one golden rule for being a good instructor, and that is that you really care about the success of your students. I can't say it enough. You need to really care personally about the success of your students. Now, from there, everything else takes care of itself, right? Because you are going to find the best way that they learn. You're going to find the things that are holding them back and help them along with that. You're going to be there as an encouragement. You're going to be there in some cases as a mentor. And of course, you'll be there eventually, and once you figure out all the other psychological stuff, you'll be there to drive home the lessons that will make them a safe pilot. But if you don't care from the outset, if all you're trying to do is build hours, then it'll fall on deaf ears. The learning transfer won't really happen well, and they will struggle. I don't believe that every instructor can teach every student. In other words, there is this dating game a little bit that happens with instructors. If it needs to, it's not always the case, but sometimes there's just a personality mismatch, and it's important to find someone you can work with. Most of the time it's good, but I would say if you're a student, find the best situation for you that you really feel is working. And if you're an instructor, don't feel bad to fire a student. I want to be careful saying that, because we instructors, we take that very seriously, and we don't just do it to anyone. And I've never fired a student before, but it's something that I have on the table. If someone is not following directions, if they're not basically totally resistant to the way I teach, etc., then you know, I'm taking their money and they're not getting anything out of it. So that's something, like, on a personal level, I don't like to do. That's just my thoughts there. So again, get back to the golden rule: care about their success and make sure that it happens to the best of your ability. Okay, flaps or no flaps for high wind, crosswind landing? It just depends. I typically do a reduced amount of flaps for high winds. Typically because when I get in the flare, and if I get a gust of wind, then I just pop back up and I'm floating too long. So that's typically why I do reduced amount of flaps. Of course, we know that we can, in most training airplanes, we can take off with flaps and we can land with flaps, and we can take off without flaps and land without flaps. So it just kind of depends. It really just depends. Go by what your pilot operating handbook says, see what it looks like in there. Most of them will say that you can reduce the amount of flaps for your landing. But again, refer to that, because that's always the holy grail. Interesting question here. Ever lose the motivation to teach? What keeps you going? I don't really lose the motivation to teach. I think for me, I really enjoy seeing students achieve their dreams and make progress. It's like a drug for me, in a way, and it's one of the best things that I have in aviation. I love the flying, and I love to fly myself, and I love sharing aviation too. You guys have seen that through my social media. But the thing I love the most is actually seeing people achieve their goals and their dreams. It's really cool, for example, just as like one example that I always enjoy during the training process, when I have a student that is brand new and I get to take them through all the way, and I see them during the solo part of their training, which is not too far in, but already I'm seeing the effects of my training. And I see them doing things the way I do things. And I see them, like, right as I think of something, they reach for that item, or they look to that part of the sky, or they make that turn. And it's like, it's so cool to see me in my student. It's also quite frightening sometimes, so I'm really careful not to teach bad lessons, but I really watch myself and try to lead by example there. But that is so cool to see that happen. And I think for the most part, it's for the best. And I just really enjoy that. So that keeps me motivated as I move throughout my training. So that's why I really love being an instructor. And kind of a bit of a piggyback off of the last question, one thing I do want to mention is that if you don't love instructing and you don't enjoy it, then please don't waste people's time don't waste their time and money if you're not a good instructor, essentially, or you don't care about them. Like, do something else. Build your time in some other way. I'm a student aspiring to do a private pilot license. Do you have any advice against air sickness? Just a couple pieces of advice here. Flying during the parts of the day that are really smooth is going to be important for you. So morning flights, evening flights are the best. When the winds are dying down, that's more like a summer strategy for most places, because the heating that goes on is causing a lot of those winds to move around. And I'd also say that I read this book by an airline pilot that had a terrible time during her private pilot or primary training with air sickness. And it turns out that flying at night really helped her out. So she did most of her time at night. She was in the San Diego area doing her training, I think. So that helped, because there was so much reference to the ground just by virtue of lights. But training at night really helped her. So there are some different strategies. I don't know if that's something you're just nervous about, or if you know that you get air sick, but the more you build that muscle against it and don't let loose, in other words, you don't throw up, the more you'll build a muscle against it. So those are my pieces of advice. Just schedule for those times. It might mean some early mornings. So keep that in mind, okay? At what point would you recommend introducing ForeFlight on your private pilot license? So I would recommend that you take your written test and your knowledge study very seriously. You go through and you learn how to do the paper way there, and you learn where everything comes from, and that you do a paper flight plan with your instructor when you're first going through your training, okay? So you learn the old school way. A lot of my colleagues will disagree with me on this, but I think that ForeFlight should be primarily in the private pilot training. So after you've learned where the terms come from and why things are the way they are, then you go to ForeFlight. The reason why I have settled on that, I'm not completely settled, I guess I should never be stuck in my ways, but the reason why I've settled for now on that is that I know that when you are going to go out there as a private pilot, that you're going to use ForeFlight. So if you learn it from me and you learn the safe habits of using it from me, then you are going to be safer using it when I release you to the wild after your check ride, or rather for your check ride, and then you get to go on and do your own thing. But if you don't know it at that point, then you're gonna try to learn it by yourself, and you're not gonna know all these cool little features and how to best organize, when not to use the iPad or the phone. So I like to build it into the safety and decision-making pretty early on and use it as a tool early on, rather than just releasing someone to the wild. Now, kind of a comparison I make here is I wouldn't necessarily force, if I was a photography teacher, all right, even though I went through this myself, I wouldn't force someone right now to go and get a film camera and use a camera with film just so they could learn those old terms and how everything works. That's not what I would do, okay? It doesn't make any sense to me. And it's very similar, because then when you go over to digital, a lot of the terms are still the same. We've got aperture, we've got f-stop, we've got framing, we've got ISO, we've got all these different things that are the same, and they mean something, but it's better just to learn on digital just because it's easier. And I think the same thing with ForeFlight and with flight planning, because we're talking about magnetic headings and magnetic course and wind correction angles and all these different things that ForeFlight is doing on the fly. And I just think it's a tool in today's very high information age that helps us pilots reduce the amount of clutter and synthesize things better and get to the information that matters quicker, so we can use that as a safety tool to focus on the decision making and the risk management. I just remember the night of my check ride, private pilot, of course, this was the days when ForeFlight didn't exist and EFBs didn't exist. I was up for 4 hours doing my flight plan, okay? 4 hours the night before my check ride. I was like shot during my check ride. So I don't agree with that. I think we have to have, in today's, again, very high information age, we have to have a way to synthesize that down and get to the data that really matters. And I think ForeFlight really helps with that. So that was a really long answer, but I hope that helped. What advice would you have for someone going through Part 141 training? A lot of the times with Part 141 training, you can be learning from someone that is a fairly new instructor. I went through 141 for my private pilot, had a really good time, and I had a great instructor, even though he was a new instructor, okay? So I'm not saying that just because it's a new instructor or not experienced, they're not a good instructor, but their experience of flying is fairly limited. Like, they haven't been flying a long time, they haven't seen a lot of things, and so there aren't a lot of those stories or experiences to pass on, okay? So I would say that for you to have the best experience in Part 141 training is, and this goes for 61 as well, expand your resources, find other places to learn things that will help you. And in today's day and age, there are great podcasts out there, okay? Great YouTube videos. Be a little bit careful there, because people do some dumb things. But just a wealth of information for you to gain those lessons from other people that do have a lot of experience. And then you can take that into your training with what I am going to assume is actually a good instructor that just maybe has not the greatest breadth of experience, okay? So I would also say one other thing in 141 training that I didn't really appreciate is 141 training, they think they are the best at everything. They think they know everything. They think they have it down. There's just a lot of ego involved. And so my advice there is don't absorb the know-it-all mentality that comes from a lot of these 141 schools. You have a lot to learn after you get your licenses and as you grow. You have a ton to learn. And what I'm suggesting here with these other sources is that you voluntarily learn from those other sources right now so that you're more solid right now. Because I just remember when I went through 141 training, we talked all about different grades of fuel, all right? It was a specific example. Talk about different grades of fuel. You never put a different kind of fuel in your airplane. And if you do, then the engine's going to blow up and you're going to crash and die. Well, then right after my private pilot, my family was thinking of buying a Bonanza. And so I go to Iowa to this guy that has like 20,000 hours, and he puts Mogas in the Bonanza, and I'm I'm thinking we're going to die. Like, there's no way. Like, why would you put different fuel in this airplane? But it's just this limited view, okay? Because I had these blinders on, and everyone told me that I would die if I put a different type of fuel in my engine. But guess what? Those engines were made to do that. Low lead wasn't like a prevalent thing so much. And so they had these engines that were tested and worked fine on MoGas. Certain octane still, but, you know, I just had to... I had to become humble. So I guess that's the gist of what I'm saying. Be humble. Just settle down into it. Okay. Good question. Okay. I'm just going to suggest something really quick here for this particular question, because I have a podcast you can go and check out. I think it's even an hour long. So I'm getting close to my private pilot written. What is your best advice to pass it? It is still in this, this podcast that I did called The Pass in Passion. So if you search The Pass in Passion Aviator Cast just in Google, it's going to pop right up, okay? If you just search The Pass in Passion, then like a bunch of stuff about Christ comes up, and it's going to take a while to find my podcast. So The Pass in Passion Aviator Cast, you'll find an hour long on this specific subject right there. And then of course, subscribe to the podcast as well. As a low hour pilot, while renting a Cessna 172 throughout my training in a DA-40 as I continue my instrument rating and CPL. If you're already a private pilot and you're flying single engine, I would say at this point, you know the indications of certain things and how to do certain things. In other words, you know that to get the operating limitations of an airplane, you go to the operating handbook. You know that that a stall is a stall pretty much, and if you keep holding that nose back and you don't release the pressure, then you're probably gonna stall. And you typically know how to take off regardless of what it is. So my advice there would be, there's actually a lot to learn in flying different airplanes. And so after you're a private pilot, I think it's cool to explore different airplanes and how they operate. You learn a lot more about these concepts that were driven into you as a private pilot when you do that, and you see how the aircraft manufacturers design airplanes differently and why or what it is about that airplane aerodynamically that makes it different. So I would say there's actually a lot to learn about flying in different types of airplanes. So I would encourage you to go fly something different, especially renting a 172. It's such a docile airplane that I think you'll really enjoy it. It'll just be a different experience for you. So absolutely, go explore. You have your aircraft single engine land. Go do it, you know, get after it. What's going on in the aviation industry? Too many accidents. So I am here in this super ugly hotel room, okay? I've been here this weekend in Sacramento, California. I've been doing what's called a flight instructor refresher course, which is something that instructors have to go through every 2 years. There are some ways to get around that, but I decided to come here because my friend Jason Miller from the Finer Points was running the class, and I thought it would be great to learn and be a part of that. Jason is big on safety. He's big on looking at accidents, looking at the trends, and finding out how we as pilots can change things, or we as instructors specifically can change things. And one of the big questions that one of the big points that came out of this course this weekend was, we as instructors were one of the last lines of defense between pilots and those accidents actually happening. So I think a reason a lot of these accidents are happening just boil down to the same old reasons. They are the same accidents that are happening again and again and again, and it is so frustrating from an instructor's perspective that the same thing keeps happening. Some of the biggest accidents, of course, are controlled flight into terrain, or what we call CFIT, VMC into IMC, which is basically your visual and you fly into the clouds and then you get disoriented and people get messed up that way as well. Can kind of be a combination of the two where it's VFR into IMC and then you hit terrain. So as an example, the Kobe Bryant incident looks like something like that, where the pilot persisted into bad weather. He got disoriented and they crashed into terrain. Looks like the pilot was even descending into kind of a spiral while that was happening. The airplane was complete. The helicopter was completely fine. That seems to be the preliminary data, and that's what happened. So he was an 8,200 hour helicopter pilot, and there's no way that he hadn't done something like this similar before, and maybe hundreds of times, especially helicopters where he's probably operating just around LA, not doing a ton of cross country to build that time. He's doing lots of repetitions of just flying over highways, flying in low weather. And so what I do as an instructor, okay, because it all comes down to like the individual, it comes down to us and our decision to be safe pilots, is I try to look at accidents and attitudes as a sense of humility. Again, I come back to the humility word a lot, because here's this 8,200 hour pilot in the Kobe Bryant incident, and I have nowhere near that amount of hours. That guy is way more experienced than I am. So who am I to sit back and say he was an idiot, he did all these things that were terrible and they were wrong? Rather, how could I have gotten myself in that situation? I assume out the gate that I would get myself in that situation. So then I look back prior in the flight, and I say, okay, assuming that I would have the external pressures to take this celebrity and drop them off, or I felt like I had the experience to do this, where do I break the chain of events here? Do I land in Burbank? He had the opportunity to do so. Where do I stop this? Because I know that I have the ability to fly pretty well all the way up until the accident like this guy did. But I know that I am also not invulnerable, and I can do that, and I have the potential to do that. So I have to ask myself, where am I gonna stop? And I do have a golden rule. This is a little bit of a tangent. I do have a golden rule that I'm always going to return home safe to my family. And so I'm going to do everything in my power to mitigate risk, apart from just not flying, okay? Because that's the best way to mitigate the risk, but that's not going to happen. But how do I return home to my family every time? And, you know, there are some times where we just need to give ourselves as pilots. I was talking to Jason about this yesterday's lunch, at lunch. We need to give ourselves as pilots the permission to throw everything aside, absolutely everything, and stop what we're doing and land safely and call it good, fly another day. And that could have happened dozens of times in this Kobe Bryant incident, in many different incidents I see. I mean, just again and again and again, people are making mistakes. And we need to give ourselves, again, the permission to stop what we're doing, stop the chain of events, land. There is nothing in the world that is more important than returning or getting there alive, okay? There's nothing more important than that, unless you just have a death wish, which people don't have consciously. Okay, so that is my advice on the safety thing. It comes down to the individual. I'm not sure why, as a society, it's happening. I'm going to leave that up to the experts to figure out why psychologically, as a whole, there seem to be more accidents. I think there are a lot of theories there, but it comes down to you. You can't just look at other people and say, oh, they're doing dumb things. Don't do that. Like, assume that you would do those dumb things too. And if I do nothing else in my career but help people realize that and help them stop those chain of events and like save themselves, then I've done a good job. So that's kind of my soapbox right now. A little bit of passion there, having seen so many things over this this weekend as instructors with this flight instructor refresher course, plus the recent accidents that have been happening. So gosh, guys, just be safe. Just stop the chain of events. Just stop what you're doing and don't fly. Like, you don't have to fly. No matter what your position is, no matter who you fly for, okay? If it's unsafe, you don't have to do it. Okay, this is interesting. How do you cope with a school that has a culture of breaking FARs? Stay and be the black sheep or leave? You have a couple options before that happens. You can go talk to the chief pilot, tell them what is happening. Okay, tell them if your instructors, especially the lower rungs, are doing things that are unsafe or whatever it is, go talk to the chief pilot. If that falls on deaf ears and the FARs that they're breaking, I don't know what they're breaking, okay? I'm just assuming that you're telling the truth and you know what you're talking about and that they are willfully breaking things, then yeah, absolutely leave, okay? I think that is appropriate and you should do that because it becomes a safety thing. At that point, I would even maybe talk to the FISDO. I would maybe even report them, all right? Be careful with that. I don't think we want to just start accusing everyone and being tattletales, but when it is appropriate safety-wise, especially for other people, I think it's really important to report people. But be careful with that. So I want to leave you with some thoughts and some places to go. I do offer online ground school here at Angle of Attack. Just go to angleofattack.com and you can find that for private and instrument. I'll be creating some for other licenses later. I do have Check Ride Ace, which is a check ride preparation program. You can find that out. Find that at angleofattack.com or checkrideace.com. Really proud of that program. That's fairly new and prepares you for the check ride in that last week or so. You can also check out the Aviator Cast podcast, all right? I share one every single week. It's a new and interesting topic. I'm going to be doing more interviews soon. I also put these Motivation Mondays on there now. So you can check out AviatorCast, subscribe wherever you are, iTunes, Spotify, wherever. And just be part of the community, okay? I'm really active on Instagram. If you guys ever need anything, please reach out. That helps me learn and grow. And I really wish you the best luck in your training. I hope that I see you here in the next week involved in aviation on social media. So keep up the good work, be safe, and throttle on.